Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Most people, I expect, know Samuel Clemens for all of the writing that he produced as Mark Twain. But in addition to being a writer, Clemens was also a printer, a publisher, he was an inventor, and he was also a media celebrity. Our guest for this hour, Bruce Michelson, he's a professor of English here at the U of I, says that maybe we fail to appreciate just how obsessed Samuel Clemens was with the media technology of his time. He says that Clemens thought very deeply about the cultural impact of the very dramatic expansion of publishing that began to sweep the country when he was growing up. And this morning we'll be talking about how this growing potential of print media contributed to the way that Clemens wrote and what he wrote about. This is the subject of Bruce Michelson's book, Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution, a book that was published, was it last year? Was it in 2000?
End of last year.
End of last year. Our guest is Professor of English here at the U of I, also Director of the Campus Honors Program. He's written also a number of other things about Twain and has written articles and book chapters not only on Mark Twain but other American writers, Edith Wharton, Robert Lowell, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Scott Fitzgerald, Saul Bellow, and Emily Dickinson, just to name a few. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me on.
Among the many interesting things about Twain, I think, is the fact that he arguably was the first American celebrity in the sense that we use that word today. Maybe not the first, but certainly one of the first. He was one of the best-known Americans of his time. Not only was he known by Americans, he was known around the world. And still today, I think if we put together a photo gallery of some of the authors that you've written about, I'm guessing that probably for most people, the only person they could pick out of a lineup would be Twain. You show him a picture of Mark Twain, people know, still now people know who he is, much more so than, you know, Scott Fitzgerald or Emily Dickinson.
Right. He got more media attention than any of those other people combined. And he was very good at seeking it out, and he got lucky in that he came into his own as a writer just as all sorts of technologies were hitting, which made it possible to be a worldwide celebrity. He was doing photo ops at the end of the 19th century, and that's when he went to that white suit thing because he knew it looked cool against a dark background. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was sealskin coats and other kinds of outlandish gear. He knew that telegraph wire services were coming in, so if he did an interview was basically a new thing that came along when he was in his late teens. It could spread out over a network and get into all sorts of hungry local and regional newspapers. He worked with press agents. He worked with major scheduling services for speakers and lecturers. And he was very good on positioning himself right where the action was going to be. And when he was living in New York around 1900, he would time his trips down Fifth Avenue, the big fashion street then as now, in an open carriage for just the hour when people were getting out of church so they could say, ooh, there's Mark Twain.
Yeah. He, in a very deliberate way, he created the character. He created Mark Twain and seemed that he understood very well what it would take to make that character someone who not only would interest people, would fascinate people, but perhaps also would, maybe it was marketing. It was something that he really understood.
Yeah, and that's where it gets interesting with regard to reading the literature again, is you see him get tangled up in it, and you see him get caught up in anxieties having to do with, who am I now as I write? What are the relationships that I can maintain and the barriers I can establish between who I, quote-unquote, really am and what's out there bouncing around, you know, in really a global media situation. Hmm. And one of the things that brought me back to Mark Twain, I cheat on him a lot, as you saw from my, if you stay with Twain, you'll disappear into him. He'll eat you.
Yeah.
When I came back around this time, because we're obviously in a situation where the media world that we live in is changing and ramifying every 15 minutes, hmm. and we're constantly dealing with this. Who are these celebrities who jump up in front of us, you know, on the tube or you know, off the radio when we're trying to just negotiate our regular lives? What does it mean to be an author now when I'm told by major authors you have to exist also in Second Life? You have to have a cyber identity, even though what you'd really like to do is hide up in northern Michigan and just write books. There's only a handful of people who can actually get away with that now. And if you're thinking about what it is that makes an American self, what it is that creates a personal identity that can breathe this air we're in now, you're opening up also into really complicated and turbulent questions. We can go back to Mark Twain, look at his obsession with printing technology, the media business, national, international, copyright relationships, the whole nine yards, and see him struggle with some of those issues. It provides a kind of companionship relationship between Twain and us that we might need right now.
Yeah. So I suppose one should be careful about taking characters from other times and saying they'd fit in just perfectly with where we are. But it sounds as if more than perhaps many people in today's media environment, Twain would once he got his sea legs, he probably would feel pretty comfortable.
He loved every gimmick that was coming down, and he was very good on losing a lot of money by always betting on the wrong horse, even in a two-horse race. $300,000 squandered on a typesetting machine, which was probably, still is probably the most elegant typesetting device ever conceived by human beings. 18,000 moving parts. It was wonderful. It just didn't work very well. He bought into illustration technology when illustration was going through a tremendous revolution. You had all these various kinds of photo engraving hitting at once. Again, he bet on the wrong thing, $50,000 down the tube there. Founded his own publishing house so he could run everything that happened under his purview, control every aspect of his own books. He had some smash hit bestsellers, the Personal Memoirs of U.S. Grant. That was his book, but he still managed to run that into the ground by driving his CEO and his company crazy with one harebrained expansion idea after another. Even bet on the wrong electric motor. He invested in a direct current and bet against Tesla. Yeah. But the point is, he was always trying to do stuff. He always wanted the latest, coolest technology showing up in his books. And at the same time, he's wondering, what is this doing to us as a culture? An awful lot of this pops up in Huckleberry Finn, and it certainly pops up in some of the late writings.
Well, let's take a step back here, because I suppose I mentioned the title of the book. Perhaps I should ask you, what is a printer's devil?
Printer's devil is a roustabout apprentice, usually a kid, in an old-fashioned type print shop, and that's where he started out. Several of the Clemens brothers, because there weren't too many other opportunities in Hannibal, Missouri, got apprenticed to a guy named Joe Ament, who had a shop. He was running a newspaper in town. He couldn't make any money running newspapers in a town of 3,000, but people kept beating their heads against the wall trying to produce these country papers. That's where he learned a technology which really went pretty much straight back to the Gutenbergs. They were working with a Washington hand press, which is an old-fashioned, you know, yank the lever, put the sheets in one at a time kind of a press. And if you were really feeling good and everything was working fine in the shop, you could do 800 sheets a day. He goes in there in 1850. At just that point, the Robert Hoe Company has broken through, and they're producing, they have a steam-powered rotary press that can wham out 20,000 sheets an hour. So he's just there in a moment where this vast gap is opening up between printing as it existed since the Renaissance, and this whole revolution that was busting out in the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s.
And there's a number of things, and you write about them in the book. There are a number of things that all come together. The technology, the printing press, the availability of inexpensive paper, the fact that we have the telegraph so that communications can move at that speed, that it makes it possible for us to start to have what I guess we would recognize as national mass media.
Yeah, if you graft it out, I mean, from Gutenberg on up till about 1830, I mean, it's a pretty steady technological line there. They're pretty much using the same thing. They move from wooden presses to iron, and they come up with a few hand devices which move things along. But from 1830, suddenly, what they're calling steam and lightning changes everything. One of the things we've forgotten about is a tremendous breakthrough is electrotype. I don't want to bore you about this, but this was a technology which for the first time allowed you to reproduce the means of reproduction. Once you set the type up in a form, you make a mold of it, and then you put it into a battery, which was a big kind of box. And this would lay down a layer of copper, which gave you a exact copy of your set type. You could make as many of these things as you wanted. You could bend them. You could ship them. You could store them. And so you could set up 20 presses if you needed to, and these things would not wear out. And you could also fight over them as a quid pro quo in business negotiations as to who was going to control the electrodes. You could also make counterfeit electrodes. The same company that made the electrodes for your publishing house in the daytime could come back after hours, whip out a few more, ship them to Canada. And so Twain's fighting counterfeit editions on occasion, which are exactly like the editions he's about to publish in the United States. So it really gets to be fun right in there. But that's one of about 40 things that happen to change everything.
So piracy is not a new issue.
No, no. We were, the United States was kind of the Pirates of the Caribbean through the, to the end of the 19th century. There's famous stories about Dickens coming over here on lecture tours in the 1850s and being furious, facing crowds of hundreds and thousands of people, all of whom had read his books, and none of whom had paid him a dime because these pirate editions were coming over. Well, they buy a copy of the book on the London streets, or even if it was coming out in serial form, it would hit New York about 2 weeks later by the steamships and be counterfeited up and printed out all over with no payment of copyrights. It was actually Twain who raised such a ruckus in the 1890s about how he was getting ripped off that finally got America to sign an international copyright agreement. That was 1892-93.
Yeah, just for a moment, I know that you're very interested in printing technology and about how things developed. But just to again to give people the appreciation for what a leap it was when we go to the point where type was set by hand and every letter was an individual piece, and somebody, some person, had to sit down there and pick each letter out by, put them in a little row and get that, and that way you made up a page, and that's what you made your printing. From that to something that, where there was no human hand, you didn't pick out the type, you typed on a, what we have now is what we had, you type on a keyboard, you type up what it is, and that the pieces are actually cast. And the whole thing comes together that way.
Right. The big breakthrough, again, that Twain bet against was the Linotype machine invented by a German immigrant named Ottmar Mergenthaler. And he came up with a shortcut that Twain thought was very crude, where instead of picking out individual letters of movable type, you just cast a lead slug, used it, and then melted it down. Mm-hmm. Twain said, oh, this is terribly inelegant. He was buying into the page typesetter, as it was called, because it was as close to being a cyborg, a robot, as he could get. And this thing would not only set the type perfectly, it would distribute it. That's where it went completely nuts. In other words, it would take that form of type, that set type, and reach in and feel around with a kind of a braille system, take those individual letters and put them back into individual raceways in order to use them again. Right. And that never worked.
Yeah. That's one of the things that when you read biographies of Twain, or particularly, I imagine, short ones, alongside of his success as a writer, there is his failure in business. And somehow this is just a sort of a commonplace that for whatever else he was, he didn't invest very well, and he put his money into a lot of businesses that weren't successful. How is that? You think that's selling him short?
I think it sort of changes the lighting on him in ways which are not helpful right now. It's factually true, but that undertone of lament in the biographies, oh, wouldn't it be nice if Twain was like the American Proust, if he just lay in bed and wrote, and let everybody else handle his worldly affairs, or like Balzac, sit around in a bathrobe, drink coffee, and write more novels. Yeah, we'd have more novels, but they wouldn't be about this turmoil. And some of the really exciting stuff is about these transformations. So one of the things I think we have to do is, with full regard for the historical record, shift Twain so that he lives in some ways in the world that we live in, where you've got to think about how the groundwork of your communication system and your culture and everything is being changed by these technological leaps. And that's where it gets to be fun. Go back and look at Huckleberry Finn or Connecticut Yankee or Mysterious Stranger and say, okay, what about these books as being about certain kinds of print revolution, certain changes in media, which then change everything else.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English and also director of the Campus Honors Program. Has written quite a bit about Mark Twain, including his book published last year, Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution. It's a book that takes a look at Twain's interest in printing and publishing technology and how that influenced his work. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You write in the book that the fact that Twain was trained as a printer before being trained as anything else, and that his interest in printing and what it could do, in a sense, set the direction for the rest of his life. Do you think that it is the case that, as a writer, if you look at what it is that he writes about, the fact that he started out working in that print shop, as opposed to, who knows what else he could have done, that having that experience, having that hands-on experience with printing, does that help set his subject matter, what it is that he writes about?
I think it does, and I think it creates a certain vertigo about the permanence and the ephemerality of printed words that stays with him through the rest of his life. His brother Orion owned the newspaper that Sam eventually worked with until he finally was able to get enough money to get out of there. And Orion was constantly finding reasons to get out of town. And so he's leaving his 15-year-old kid brother, this exuberant, mischievous kid, in charge of the whole newspaper. Now, it's not much of a newspaper. It's a weekly four-pager, whether they eventually try to push it to a daily, but that doesn't work. And two of the four pages are basically advertisements for these big new national magazines that are going to kill the small-town paper. Mm-hmm. Including Orion's. But so Twain has the fun of he's not only setting the type and transcribing and stealing stories from the St. Louis paper, he's writing stories, he's making up news, he's making up stuff which is kind of in a gray zone between the real and the parodic. He's writing crank letters from the outside to the editor and then answering. I mean, Orion has left the animals in charge of the zoo. And so Twain has the euphoria of, I am the voice of Hannibal. You know, I not only write it, I set it in type. It looks gorgeous or pretty good when it comes out of the press and gets folded up and sold to whoever in town's willing to buy it. But the next day, it's under the canary. In other words, it's gone. And so that feeling that somehow type, words in type can have an enormous cultural impact, can shape other people's views of reality, is something that stays with them.
Yeah.
And that pops up again in some of the major novels. And also this idea that it's all going to go out the window and take me with it at some point. When he starts writing, when he's actually in that print shop, the typical book publication, new titles produced in the United States, is about 500 a year. That's it. Once he gets to the end of the 19th century, it's about 4,500 to 5,000 a year, depending on what you count. For comparison, we're now at 140 titles a day. So, you know, I think Twain can look ahead and say, oh, my God, where are we going with this? I'm going to be swept away in a tide of language.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting just to think about particularly him at that, for any writer, but him at that age. He could be sitting in his room writing in a journal, but the idea that he could write something and then produce a printed version, which would then be distributed around town, must have been must have given him a feeling of power like almost nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, you basically had a technological lock on the media in this little village he was in, and again, it stayed with him in that love for gimmicks. He was the first guy to at least he bragged he was the first American author of any note to produce a manuscript on a typewriter. You know, when telephones came in, he was the first private citizen in Hartford to have a telephone. You know, in a separate booth off of his living room. You know, the latest, the coolest, the greatest. A lot of us live this way. We buy the new toys at the box store all the time. We take them home, read the 1,000-page manual, or just wing it, knowing full well that in 6 months, it's over. You know, the next thing's going to come down, and all this stuff goes, God knows where, to a Chinese landfill. That's fun, certainly. It makes Christmas exciting every year, but it's also scary. Yeah. And I think you see that kind of duality in his own writing.
He, I'm sure for most people, will know him for Huckleberry Finn, but he produced a lot of other writing, and one of his biggest successes and first successes was travel writing.
Right. He made more money with the travel books than he ever made off the novels.
How did his interest and experience with printing and publishing, did it shape that work, or how did it shape that work?
Luck had a lot to do with it. He kind of fell into it. He was sent by a California newspaper called the Alta California to be the correspondent for that newspaper, writing travel letters back from what turned out to be the first tourist attack by the United States on Europe. This is right after the Civil War, 1867. It was a whole new idea to take a steamship that would hold about 300 people, equip it strictly for touring. You weren't just going along as stateroom passengers on a frigate or, you know, on a freight boat, and tour around Europe and the Holy Land. This was the beginning of the American invasion. And Twain happens to be on that. He writes these travels letters back, and then he hooks up with the biggest and one of the sleaziest subscription trade publishing houses in the United States, the American Publishing Company, which is based in Hartford, run by a guy named Alicia Bliss. And they are selling books door to door. And they want big, fat books that will get, let's face it, bored Midwestern farm wives through the winter. You know, they're married to Elmer's coming in out of the fields in November. He's going to sit there till April. She wants something for $2, which is a lot of money, which is going to be thick, full of chatty stuff, information, misinformation, humor, sentiment, and pictures. And two-thirds of the books in the 1870s in the United States are being sold door-to-door this way. And Twain is writing for that, which is one of the reasons sometimes with his books you got to stop reading halfway or two-thirds of the way through, because he starts, you know, he gets a good book and then he pumps in the helium, because the subscription trade is the more the merrier in terms of the thickness of the volume.
And for these kinds of books, and for him, illustration was really important.
Absolutely. I mean, we find that he's actually, in some cases, commissioning the illustrations, hiring the illustrator before he starts writing. This gets to an anomaly with regard to scholarship. One of the things we did through most of the 20th century, and we're still doing it now, when we turn out a scholarly edition, you know, of Mark Twain, first thing we do pathologically, you've got to take those pictures out, you know. And but Twain wants them in there. In fact, he's writing in order to be sort of aerated or leavened with pictures. And in some ways, that frees him up. So if his chapter meanders around, you can skip the prose and look at the pictures. One little trick they're doing, the American company, publishing company is doing, they keep doing it till they go bust, is they're putting in full-page illustrations. They're tipping them in. In other words, there's nothing on the back of the picture. And the reason they're doing that, technologically, they could use a thick piece of paper and run print down the side. But the idea is that, again, your village wife can take out scissors and chop that thing out. And if she wants a picture of the Parthenon on the wall of the sod house or whatever, she's got it. So it's interior decoration as well as everything else.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with someone here. We have a caller from Belgium, a community not far away over by Danville, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. I have a question for your author, and maybe this isn't strictly along the lines of typesetting and stuff like that and the printing aspect of it, but I find it so very interesting that of all the things Twain has done and all the things that he's written and everything we go along with, we always think of him along a river. I mean, everybody, they only remember things about Twain, it seems, for the most part. I mean, obviously, you folks know a lot more about him than the average person. But if you talk to any individual, he's a riverboat pilot. He wrote a few books about the river. And just leave it at that. When, as you said, one of the most definitive autobiographies that ever written was about Grant, and very famous to this day. The stuff he did in the gold fields was very unique also. All the stuff in between. But we always remember the river.
He was the first author to actually do a world tour. When he went bust in 1895, he got himself into a plan which took him to Australia, New Zealand, India, South Africa, and around to Europe. One of his fattest books came out of that. It's called Following the Equator. It's not regarded as a great one, but it is. It's lavishly illustrated and full of the accounts of that Asian and South African experience. Yeah, I think as we sort through all of the stuff that he wrote, we tend to go back again and again to the Mississippi River as the world where his imagination was most fired up. That's where we get Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn in the wonderful chapters of Old Times on the Mississippi. It seems like when he's speaking in a voice which remains compelling over the generations, it's a voice from that Mississippi heartland.
He seemed to take these trips and stuff only when he needed money, too, didn't he?
Yeah,
I
mean,
go out here and raise a few bucks on that circuit.
Yeah, I mean, he claimed he hated speaking tours, but he would often overextend himself. Ron Powers, who was on the show last, who referred to Twain as the first rock star, that makes sense. In that, like a rock star, he spent everything that came in. He built himself a lavish, absolutely eye-popping house, which is still standing and has been restored in Hartford, Connecticut. He had a hard time paying for that. He liked to live large. He had expensive recreational habits. He liked tailored suits and 300 cigars a month and first-class accommodations wherever he went. So when the cupboard got bare or the economic wells got low, he would, you know, buck up, go do a speaking tour and try to get a travel book out. And as I said, those were his bread and butter in his lifetime.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Bruce Michelson, is professor of English at the University of Illinois, is director of the Campus Honors Program, has written about Mark Twain and other writers, including Edith Wharton, Robert Lowell, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Scott Fitzgerald, Saul Bellow, Emily Dickinson. He has authored a book about Mark Twain and his interest in media technology. The title is Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800 1-800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk to me a little bit more about the Grant book. This was something that Grant wrote at the end of his life. He was very ill. He knew he was dying, and his interest was in trying to make some money so he could leave something to his family. Twain, right. I think, wanted to help him, but was Twain also thinking about this as being a potential bestseller and something that would also make him some money?
Oh, sure. He had a stake in it. I mean, he became a Grant admirer and stayed with Grant in a personal friendship after Grant's administration ran into terrible scandal troubles in the 1870s. Grant was dying slowly of cancer of the throat, and actually the country was still hungry for the personal memoirs of the, you know, the greatest general of the Union Army. And he was the first of a generation of general officers who wrote these personal memoirs. And they are fantastic. Grant wrote them. I mean, about every 15 years, somebody will throw an allegation out there that Mark Twain ghost wrote them. Mm-hmm. And then you got to go and dig out the holograph manuscript of Grant's memoirs in Grant's handwriting. So unless Twain dictated to Grant and knew all the action of the Army of the Potomac and the Army of Tennessee, Grant wrote them. Sure, this was a big hit, and then Twain's company, the Charles Webster Company, started signing up just about every Civil War general of any note who was still breathing, and so they did Sheridan's memoirs, they went to Custer's widow, they went to Hancock. They sort of had to race to the 1880s because those guys were fading out. But there was a whole wave of autobiographical writings by Civil War generals that followed Grant, and the Webster Company tried to make money off of those. They were doing okay, except, again, that Twain kept pushing the limits, you know, the bigger, splashier publication that hadn't been thought of before. He loses a whole bunch of money on what's the great-grandfather of the Norton Anthology of American Literature on steroids, an 11-volume... These are big octavo volume, basically everything from John Smith up until last week, and the book's being edited in the 1890s. And they're amazingly broad in their taste. There are African-American writers, there are Native American writers, there are women writers in profusion in ways that are not matched by college anthologies till the 1970s and 1980s. Again, they're charging $30 for the complete set. That's a fortune in the 1890s. You could buy I went and looked on the Sears catalog. You could buy an oak roll top desk and a carriage for $30, you know. So they had to sell this on a pay-by-the-month basis, but they had to pay the salesman up front. It was another red ink drainer. But Twain's always got these things. He's driving Charlie Webster nuts with these ideas, and he pushes the country.
Well, who did Twain think was going to buy those books?
Well,
did he think that average middle-class people would be willing to sign on and pay on a time basis to have something like that sitting on their bookshelf in their home?
Again, because publication technology had gotten easier, paper prices had gone down, and everything had automated. This was the era when Appleton and Harper's and a lot of the other major publishers were starting to do those beautifully matched uniform editions of major authors. If you go digging around in used bookstores for the complete Hawthorne, the complete Oliver Wendell Holmes, you'll find the dates are 1890 to 1910. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are building nice houses. They got bookcases on both sides of the fireplace. What are we going to put in there? And that's the beginning of the stabilization of the idea of the classic author. So, again, it was not nuts. It was just, you know, 10 feet ahead of the dock. He just went too far out and spent too much money.
Let's talk about Huckleberry Finn and about how the kind of things that we're talking about, particularly his interest in media technology and his concerns about what this explosive growth of media would mean for America, how that plays out in Huck Finn.
Yeah, I mean, part of the fun of Huckleberry Finn is you can't quite nail down how this book is getting written. I mean, the end of it says, "The end, yours truly, Huck Finn." At the beginning, in the opening page, he says, "You don't know about me without you've read a book called Adventures of Tom Sawyer." That book was written by Mr. Mark Twain. He told the truth mostly. You know, and there's clues all the way along that Huck is making this account right after those adventures. Well, if you try to sort this out, you know, it doesn't sort out. Twain's obviously working, breathing. He's got his picture in the front of the first edition. So this is the 1880s. Is he talking to Huck? Does that mean Huck's 60 years old like Mark Twain? Or are they sort of going back and forth, you know, like some Terminator episode over time zones or time warps? You can't worry too much about that. You can just enjoy the vertigo, the disorientation there. Huck seems to be imagining and living in the later 1840s, and that's just that moment when all those media are just slamming into the Mississippi heartland. They're coming up the river, hitting the villages via steamboat. And so folio albums, Eastern weeklies and monthlies and newspapers of all sorts, all this print is hitting. And it's hitting a culture which doesn't seem to be able to sort it out yet. So as Huck comes down the river, he runs into a lot of people who seem to be taking their cues on how to conduct themselves morally, how to love, how to grieve, how to shoot other people, how to justify shooting other people, all on the basis of this print that's rolling in. Mm-hmm. Obvious example is Emmeline Grangerford. She's that warped kid in that house where the Grangerfords and the Shepherdsons have been shooting each other and calling it a manly, you know, feud for years. And what's coming out of Emily is a lot of really morbid claptrap, but she's getting it from those big folio albums which are sitting neatly stacked on the table with an oilcloth in her parlor. The pictures she's putting up on the walls are kind of hideous homemade versions of the illustrations she's seeing in those things. It's not a weird quirk that of the two con men that pick up the joint, jump on the raft and Huck and Jim have to ride down with, one of them is a printer. The Duke is a printer. And occasionally he will bust into a print shop and publish up handbills and wanted posters and things like that, because he knows if it's set in type, the public's going to take it in a certain kind of way. It has a certain kind of authority. The only time he blows that is when they're trying to advertise the Royal None-such Shakespeare production. He throws a lot of gibberish down. You know, they're Edmund Garrick and Edmund Kean from Pudding Lane, Piccadilly, Whitechapel. He just sort of Cuisinart's together a lot of London names. Nobody shows up. So when he advertises the next show, he does it in a hand-lettered poster, because he knows a hand-lettered poster is local, sleazy, maybe pornographic, and he puts at the bottom, "Ladies and children not admitted." You know, and then he gets a good crowd for that. But all the way down the river, you've got people reacting to the first blow of this flood of print that's coming in. They don't really know what to do with it. It's a marginally illustrated population, and suddenly the doors have burst open. And for very little money, you can drown yourself in stuff, and you can't tell whether it's real, false, near, far. You know, there's a lot of confusion there. Yeah.
Well, that sort of literary convention that we would not have any trouble with today, that is a piece of fiction where the writer is saying to you, well, I didn't really write this. This is as told to me, and all I'm doing is basically taking down what this other character is telling me. Now, we have no trouble with the idea that this is all the work of the writer, and we sort of understand that convention. Did people at the time have any trouble with this notion, or did they immediately get, okay, I understand what Mark Twain is doing here. He's writing the story, but he's created this character that is telling the story, and he's just saying, well, I'm just taking this down as this character is telling the story to me.
I think it's Twain is sitting out there blowing through all those cigars up on that hilltop writing this thing. In Elmira, New York, he's not worrying too much about it. He's pondering it. The confusion of who am I, where am I, when am I? Going back to that first caller's question: is he a Mississippi River boy? Is he a world-class globe-trotting celebrity? Is he a plutocrat? What is he? I think that sloshes around in the book. This book was written by Mr. Mark Twain. Well, who's Mark Twain? You know, and. But again, we're going back to a more innocent time before the rise of college English departments. So I think people could countenance these questions, enjoy the blurriness, enjoy the multiplicity of possibilities without worrying too much that it was going to pop up on a midterm or a final.
Well, I guess I was thinking about the fact that that Huck Finn was a fictional character. I wasn't thinking about the fact that Mark Twain was also a fictional character in a sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Twain is he's invented a public identity, and in the 50s, a lot of Freudian interest got put into that. I mean, my God, is he tormented by the fact that his public self and his private self are so different? I think we're in a weird situation now where we might be able to understand it better. I had a wonderful conversation with students about 6 weeks ago. What's the difference between a friend and a Facebook friend? I mean, a lot of our students have alternative identities floating around in cyberspace. they may come to regret that someday because mm-hmm. those identities have a way of sort of being perpetual. You can have a lot of different kinds of selves. Your private life and your public life are being turned inside out by cell phones, by intercepted email, by things sort of circuiting the globe at light speed. Twain is really a member of a first generation that can go global with an identity.
Yeah.
And that's something which is spinning in his mind. He's not a systematic thinker. One of the reasons I can't be an all-out Twain guy is he's such a mess. You know, he's so full of contradictions and mercurial personality traits and ups and downs and shameless potboilers and genius that I got to back off and go work on Tom Stoppard once in a while, who's mm-hmm. going to polished, tidy, sharp edges everywhere. You know where you are.
It seems to me that isn't that what makes Twain so interesting to us? That he is that complex and...
He's as big a mess as the rest of us?
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, I would accept that.
Yeah, no, there's, you know, you can say all sorts of nasty things about Hawthorne or Henry James in a situation like this. Nobody will get mad. If I go out and do a talk on Mark Twain, I've always got to watch... Certain people in the audience are going to feel, this is my guy. You know, mm-hmm. you can have all the rest of the American authors. This is my author. And it sometimes gets interesting when you have two or three Mark Twain imitators in the crowd. And then, you know, you've got people who are really hardcore about this. There's a sense that the public wants Mark Twain as an emblem of an us, you know. And so when you go in and you suggest new things about him or new ways of looking at him, you got to do it delicately. There's an overwhelming pile of historical fact and record. We know an awful lot about this guy. I mean, the archives at the University of California at Berkeley just go for miles. So you can't get cute, or at least you shouldn't. At the same time, you do need to refresh your thinking about him so that he looks like us now. And I don't know where we're going, but we want Twain along for the ride, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this book.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest, Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English, director of the Campus Honors Program here at U of I, author of the recent book Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. A little earlier, you talked about the fact that as a result of the changes in, or the growth, the explosion in publishing that we talked about, the fact that you could print inexpensively newspapers and books and magazines, and so it now in small towns across the country, people had the opportunity to read a range of material, not just their small town paper, but they could read the papers from big cities elsewhere. There was all this material that they had access to, and it was from that they were learning an awful lot about the world and themselves and how to behave and so forth. Twain was also very much influenced by he read the same stuff. And
oh,
in
yeah,
fact, you
sure.
can see in his writing, in his fictional writing, obviously he was inspired by real events that he would have also read about just like everybody else.
Oh, sure. And some of his funnier and more acerbic short stuff from the middle 1860s on till about 1880 is responding to the impact and the confusion that this mass media can have. When you go back and look at the Harper's Weeklies, for example, that were being published during the Civil War, that was America's main way of following the war. Again, unprecedented media breakthrough, 150 to 200,000 copies a week circulating regionally and nationally, and with lavish illustrations and correspondence reports. And these magazines were thick. One of the things they're doing, if you go back and look at them, is the sentimental stories about, you know, dedicated women left at home and love triumphing over wounding and battle and all the rest of that are set in the same typeface in the same columns as the news story. You just slide from one into the next, and mm-hmm. the sentimental stories aren't signed. A lot of them being written by Horatio Alger. He's a young kid turning these things out. But you're bouncing along, minding your own business, reading about, you know, life in the camps in Northern Virginia, and suddenly you slide into this account. You know, how much critical thinking could you count on your ordinary reader to have to realize I am now into baloney, you know? And Twain has some fun writing satires of those kinds of stories, just puzzling over what is the impact on the ordinary person of getting war news, you know, covered with this cheese sauce, you know, mm-hmm. and he, you know, he that's as early as I can find him wondering about those kinds of effects.
We have a caller here on our line number one. I'm told in Michigan. Caller, is that right?
Yes, it's Dafter, Michigan.
Dafter, Michigan.
It's a very small town here. But can I ask, are we looking forward to an unexpurgated, fulsome autobiography of Twain to come out on the 100th year after his death?
We seem to get the truth about Mark Twain biographies every couple of years, and they get fought about. I'm not going to write it. I do know one good scholar who's planning on doing one. Ron Powers' book came out a couple of years ago, right? Ron is from Hannibal, Missouri. I think in his most exuberant moments, he feels like as a fellow Hannibalite, he can kind of channel Mark Twain. We've had, if you want to go back, we've had Freudian Mark Twain. We've had populist Mark Twain. We've had gay Mark Twain. We've had bourgeois capitalist Mark Twain. Civil rights devotee Mark Twain, racist Mark Twain. You can kind of take your pick. And again, if you prowl around in those archives far enough, you can find the Mark Twain you want.
Yeah, but I'm asking about an autobiography. I understood.
Oh, okay.
He wrote a lengthier, very explicit autobiography that he would not have published until 100 years had passed from his death.
Well, Michael Kiskis at Elmira College is planning on a scholarly autobiography of a version of Mark Twain's autobiographical writings. He did kind of a mock autobiography, and then in the last couple of years in his life, he learned about the joys of stenography, and he lay in bed, smoked cigarettes, and basically rattled off whatever occurred to him, and the stenographer put that down. And you can still buy it as a two-volume autobiography.
Oh.
It's pretty disorganized because he's just kind of rambling away.
Yeah.
But there's interesting stuff in it. I think when the University of California Press gets this together, there'll be all sorts of notes and navigation guides, and they'll be able to do searches for it. I don't know that there is some kind of triple X rated volume sitting out
Darn.
There. I think we would have heard about it. I mean,
yeah.
Scholars have been crawling all over that material for 50 years, and if there was anything awful, we would have known.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Back here to a caller in Champaign County, where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi. Speaking of undiscovered things, apparently a play, Is He Dead?, is open in December on Broadway. I just now heard about it. I read a little, Googled it, but I was hoping it was that undiscovered leftist that I think is the narrative that we miss for Twain. He was hobnobbing with all these rich folks, but he was starting the Anti-Imperialist League and haranguing people about the Philippines. So, but Is He Dead? Isn't on that subject. I think it's sort of he's thinking about his legacy because it seems to be a late play. It's a story of an artist who feigns his own death to raise prices on his works.
Yeah, it's eerily modern. Michelle Fishkin, who's a friend, found this. There was a piece about her in the New York Times yesterday, or Sunday paper, found this material. Sure, we knew it was there, and Shelley read it, and she was the first person to read it. Thought, you know, this actually could be done on the stage. It went through a major car washing and waxing to get it to the condition it's in now. But you're right, the basic gag is very modern or even postmodern. This notion that art is somehow tied into the stock market and the whole celebrity culture, and nothing helps an artist like being dead. And so that's the gag which, like a gyro, drives this thing. I actually won tickets to this thing in a lottery at a convention, but I couldn't get to New York. So I think tomorrow night my daughter's going with her boyfriend, and I expect a full first-hand candid report from a 20-something who was raised with, you know, too much proximity to Mark Twain because she had to live with me.
Huh. Well, like I said, I'm rooting for a reinterpretation, and any occasion is great for me to see, because it's pretty amazing that part of his life doesn't get more attention, in my opinion. Anyway, thanks a lot.
There was a good dramatization of the $30,000 bequest done by a small theater company in Chicago last year, which I think they're going to try to make the rounds with. I'd look for that because on the stage that worked very well.
Well, this is another way in which he seems to be a strikingly contemporary figure, in the sense that everybody seems to make the Twain that they want. Mm-hmm. And perhaps they can find, it's not simply that they make the Twain that they want, that they actually look at the record he left behind, and they can find some evidence of the Twain that they want and make the most of it, yeah. I guess, that they can.
And he liked tie-ins and spin-offs and potboilers. He sponsored a traveling stage version of The Prince and the Pauper. When the Pudd'nhead Wilson gags actually caught the public's attention much more than the novel itself did, he issued Pudd'nhead Wilson postcards with the one-liners on them. And the end of his life, you find his name on Reputation Beer, which is being produced in Houston. The Mark Twain cigars, it kept going. I mean, he knew about synergy and packaging like few people today.
So we're now down to the point of having a couple of minutes, 2-3 minutes left. At the end of his life, he was writing some interesting, some strange, some dark stuff. I guess I'm thinking of some of the things that he writes in Mysterious Stranger.
That in many ways is the wackiest and of the late writings, and the one which I think draws most closely into the theme we're talking about. He tries that story at least 3 times, and the first version, which most people know because it was published just shortly after his death, is actually a literary fraud. They took most of the first version and glued on the end of the third and put it out there actually as a Christmas story in Harper's Magazine. That's very didactic and very kind of cold and linear. The last version is where the fun is, where it's set in a printing shop. It's set in a printing shop in the Gutenberg era, 1490 in Austria, and this mysterious, magical kid comes in, who I think is in some ways the embodiment of this kind of print revolution. I know that sounds like I'm riding the pogo stick too hard, but he comes in there, he immediately learns how to do it. He's a homeless waif. He takes a lot of persecution. Then he learns how to sort of automate it with ghosts and mysterious spirits. And then he starts duplicating people. And then he starts bouncing around from one time and place and identity to another. He can be a black minstrel 1 minute, and he can be his ordinary self the next, and he turns people into cats. I mean, I think there's something really provocative there. We start in an old-fashioned printing press, and then the world goes bonkers. And I don't think you have to push too hard to see Twain looking kind of down the tunnel at where we're going in a world where first we learn how to duplicate pages, and then what? And then what?
So it was something that would both have truly the potential, as he gave his free rein to his imagination, where he thought about where things might be going, particularly when it comes to communications media, mm-hmm. or I guess that's sort of the same thing, would it genuinely have both excited and frightened him?
Isn't that the way we feel right now?
Well, yeah.
Look at the obsession we have. We can create duplicate selves, right? We got cyborgs on Fox again. We've got reports in the BBC last week that quietly there's going to be interesting experiments in combining DNA from human and animals. Obviously, just for stem cell research. But what happens the day after tomorrow? We talked about again cyber identities floating around out there. Mm-hmm. Alternative selves that we can sort of create and promulgate. You know, I wouldn't say all bets are off with regard to the individual personality, with regard to privacy, with regard to continuity of identity, with regard to sorting out who we are in public from who we are when we're at home. But those worlds are shifting and changing around a lot. And if you look at Mysterious Stranger and you look at Huck, every time you ask Huck, who are you? And he comes up with a different name. You know, you're in a world where people are shape-shifting their identities in all sorts of provocative ways, which can keep Mark Twain fresh for us as we try to figure out where we're going for the next 15 minutes.
Yeah. When you think about what has changed in the way of media in the last just 10 years or 20, and compare that to maybe 50 years ago, you know, not only is the change from then to now staggering, but the change every year. As you particularly, I'm interested in your interaction with students who have grown up and they're the fish that don't notice the sea because they're swimming in it. Your perspective is different than theirs. Do they think very much about this at all, or do they just say, well, that's just the way that it is?
Part of the role you play as a prof is to be the stick in the mud and the gloom and doom guy. And one of the things I've learned how to do just for theatrics and just to get a conversation going is come in, brandish the news of the latest invention. I think the last one I've used this way was the iPod video. And this is the end. Nobody will be able to think straight again. Nobody will read another word. We'll all bang into a light post on the street watching downloaded episodes of Lost. And my students' reaction is, look, We handled all the crap that you guys generated over the last 20 or 25 years. We can handle this. By the way, is it for sale yet? Can I go get one this afternoon? I mean, mm-hmm. what I think gets you through this is the buoyancy, the agility, the adaptability of the young. You know, I'm too old for this stuff, but they aren't. And somehow I think they'll sort it out.
All right. Well, for that, at that, we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Bruce Michelson. He's professor of English, director of the Campus Honors Program. If you would like to read the book that we're talking about here about Mark Twain, it is Printer's Devil, Mark Twain and the American Publishing Revolution, published by University of California Press, 2006. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to wyll.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates now has four area locations, including the Oasis in the lower level of the Illini Union.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria Restaurant in downtown Champaign, presenting a beer dinner featuring beers from the Boulevard Brewing Company. Each of the four meal courses will be paired with a complimentary Boulevard beer. Seating is limited, reservations and information available at 398-7729.
No one can really say when baseball got started, but in the old days it might have been more exciting. Imagine a player having to field the ball, then throw it at the base runner.
And if they hit him, he was out. And if they didn't, they just keep pegging at him until they hit him.
Baseball back when it was fun, the pioneer era. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Three strikes, you're out.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Just about 11 o'clock on this Good Friday at WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Good morning. I'm Tom Rogers. Jason Croft is our technical director. And coming up, another edition of the Focus 580 Archives at 11:06. David Inch talked with Theolonius Monk historian Gabriel Solis, who authored the book Monk's Music. That'll be the subject of the 11 o'clock hour of the Focus 580 program here on AM 580. A flood warning is in effect for portions of southern